Blog Talk Radio.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
To the Dragon's Lair. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce that in German. One day I may tell the story behind using that name. However, not at this moment. Well, this is my first show ever. I hope I'm coming in clearly. This is my first attempt to use Skype in a significant way as well. So bear with me for any technical difficulties that may arise. Hopefully many more of these shows to come. We'll see. That will depend largely on me keeping you folks out there interested in listening. Tonight's show will be about political Judaism, in particular its effect on Gentiles, and more specifically, how it will affect us in the future. Now, first, I want to thank Kyle, Mike, and Lou for letting me come on, and in particular, Kyle and Mike for letting me be on their shows and giving me a platform. It was never really my intention to ever do this sort of thing to begin with. It just kind of happened. I would never imagine doing this about a year ago or so. So anyway, be sure and give a listen to all of the other hosts here on Renegade. Kyle on Mondays, To Be Determined, and or Wild Card Tuesdays, I guess is what that is right now. Will on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Lou on Fridays, Roundtable on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sunday nights. Now that the decks have been cleared, this network is starting to move into high gear. I think by March we'll be smoking, so hold on to your hats. For the record, today is February 10th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. Sun is at 14 degrees Aquarius. We had a new moon in Pisces earlier today. Today is also the Chinese New Year, the year of the snake. Astrologically for me, I have a solar arc Mars conjuncting my ascendant in progress. And a new moon is a good time to start any endeavor. So there you have it. There are other aspects that I have I won't bother to get into and bore you with. However, at some point, though, it'd be nice to discuss a little astrology. So if you get a chance, go over to YouTube and watch a video called Quantum Astrology. I think most people can gain from it, even if you have no knowledge of it. I will not monitor the chat, so you can call me names all you want there. I may glance at it during music breaks. We'll see. Depends on whether or not I have issues to deal with. I will be drinking my water and smoking where I'm sitting, so that will cause momentary pauses at times. Just bear with me. I do have a cat that likes to share my seat with me, and sometimes she gets a little cantankerous, but usually she is well-behaved. I do not have a dozen cats like Dennis Fecho has, okay? I do have a huge, and he is a very large, beautiful male, full-blooded, white German shepherd named Thor. I have him on the back porch right now, so hopefully he won't cause any problems with any barking. And yes, there are white German shepherds, just not as common, of course, but they're growing in popularity. Now, the chat, you can go to renegadebroadcasting.com, catch it there, or you can go to renegadebroadcasting.tutango.com, or I also highly recommend joining alternativesocial.com. It's a social network that Kyle owns. There's a chat feature there, so you can post and read and listen and chat at the same time. Some things to discuss before getting into the show topic tonight. This show generally will be about any and all issues related to the general welfare of our people that I feel confident enough to discuss. However, I'm not always on top of current events, so that may or may not be topical. We'll see as time goes on. The next item of discussion is I want to point to the past archives of my appearances on other people's shows. I don't like to have to always refer back to my shows, and I really don't like to have to repeat information all the time either. So I really would like you all to go to download them and give them a listen if you have not already. If you go to www.startheoryradio.com and look for the archives of his shows for July 7th of 2012, and October 20th, 2012. And then also go to losden.blogspot.com and look for the archives of Mike's shows, I believe September 14th, 2012, and October 28th, 2012. I believe I have that correct. I just recently did a show here with Mike on Renegade on January 24th of this year. I also did a long phone call in with Lou on the subjects of Christian identity and British Israel on January 11th. So check out those archives here as well. Again, I really don't like to have to repeat information all the time, but I suppose it may be necessary at times. But you'll be doing me a huge favor by listening to these previous shows. A lot of work went into some of them. Maybe some can post links in the chat room as well for these archives, please, if you if anyone's listening who can do that. In the future, I'll just refer to this show to find the other ones. That's the simplest thing to do. I don't have any personal website or blog as of yet. I don't quite know what I would do with one if I did have one, other than perhaps post links for websites or for downloading files. For this show, I'm not going to take any calls. If you, however, want to contact me in the future or just tell me what you think of me, you can send an email to magus_18@geocities.com. That's magus_18@geocities.com. Subscribe if you want to be on my e-list or just write me. Can't always guarantee I would get around to responding to any and all emails. I told someone on my e-list I would put a plug-in for their National Socialist website. It's called theneworder.org. You can find some interesting articles there. Most of you who are familiar with me know that I'm an occultist, in particular an astrologer as well as a Satanist, and therefore also a political Satanist. I defined this term on a previous show that I mentioned earlier in the archives. So again, check out those shows. You can also go to the links on my bio here on the Renegade website to see what all I'm into. These are not my websites that I own. However, I'm affiliated with these organizations loosely. On the Renegade page, just pick on my name under the schedule for Sunday. A lot of that will be discussed here if my show continues. I certainly hope it will be well received enough for that to happen. I'll go ahead and make a clarification of what Satanism is. I know we've got some new listeners here who may not have caught some of the earlier shows. And it'll be a subject that will be discussed periodically. In my book, it is any valid spiritual practice that is not Abrahamic or that has been distorted by the anti-life Abrahamic garbage. You know, for example, Buddhism has been totally corrupted by it. Satan, the word, means truth in Sanskrit, and that predates Hebrew by probably thousands of years. The Hebrews turned truth, or the word Satan, into their word for adversary. Properly, it's called Satanama, and that can be broken down into the following fashion. Sa-ta-na-ma, four syllables. Sa is birth, ta is life, na is death, ma is rebirth. And you can even break that into two parts, sata and nama. And so that would mean true name. Sata, true, nama, name. Therefore, Satan means essentially truth. Satanism is properly called Satana Dharma. That has nothing to do with evil. In fact, they reverse the word live into the word evil, and they reverse the word lived into devil. And devil is simply dark evil. Anything else identifying itself as Satanism is an imposter, such as the Jules Lavey so-called Satanism, etc., which is total bullshit. There are, however, some basic philosophies that can came out of that philosophy if they're used properly. And unfortunately, this has been used as a cover-up to point people in the wrong direction of what Satanism actually is. And if you ever meet a Jew claiming to be a Satanist, well, that's just not possible. I'm sorry. How can they be their own adversary? There is also a satanic bloodline, and they were and still are a target of the Inquisition, past and present. That Inquisition is certainly still going on today. That is partially what the purpose of the promotion of race mixing by Jews is all about. I won't discuss that at this point. However, I will say this. If you are a Gentile and you're mocking Satanism, then why are you desecrating your own cultural and or genetic roots? The Catholic Encyclopedia even states very clearly that demons are the gods of the Gentiles. More later in time, perhaps, but not tonight. Now that the dust has settled here from recent events, I feel that I can go the directions that I really want to go without having to explain how and why what you hear from me differs so significantly from those who are no longer with Renegade. Good riddance. That was a real concern for me for a while. Would anyone get the message? I just had to wait for others to figure out those people were shills. None of us will agree on all things, but there are certain significant differences with the ones who are now gone. I always feel that when there are differences such that existed, that I would need to demonstrate my stance, and I would have. So I don't have to concern myself with that any longer. As most of you know already, I'm a racial nationalist. I say that to distinguish between other perceived forms of nationalism. Never mind the word nation, basically for all intents and purposes, it means race. The butchering our language is truly unforgivable. Now, before I go on to today's topic, there's something I want to say about a particular issue that's hot right at the moment, and that is this anti-gun problem that we're having with the United States government. In my book, to say that you are anti-gun is to say that you are anti-white, because guns are white people's culture. 90% of all the people who own guns are probably white people. Now, that's just a guess, but I would venture to say it's probably accurate. Also looked up in a search engine the number 10 and then USC 311, U.S. code. Congress cannot modify the Second Amendment, nor the President can modify the Second Amendment through either of the two being legislation or executive orders. And the words in there say, clearly shall not be infringed. These so-called assault weapons are really defensive weapons, as the military publicly admits they are generally useless for any real military purpose in the form that they are in or at all. Of course, any deer rifle with a good scope can be used as a sniper rifle. Some of you know I'm age 52. I was born in 1960, so I'm an old guy compared to most of the people listening here. 1960 was the last year of the 1950s. I'm a little bit older than Dennis Fecho, who was born in 1961, which was the first year of the 1960s. So when I was born, the half-Jew Eisenhower was president. And when Fecho was born, Kennedy had become president. I was born a few hours shortly after the Nixon-Kennedy debate, so that tells you just how old I really am. So anyway, I'm certainly obviously a baby boomer. Now, I've heard some people say in some of the discussions I hear on this network and other places that they consider the baby boomers to be basically a hindrance. They're too far gone. There's no way we'll be able to get them to cooperate if we ever need them to. But let me put it to you this way. If this gun issue keeps persisting, you're going to see a whole lot of baby boomers step up. And they're not as dumb as you think they are. And if they live in the country, you can bet they're part of the gun culture. Okay? So just because they don't speak out doesn't mean they're not aware of what's going on. They just may not have all of the details. Now, I've mentioned in the past some of the topics that I wanted to cover, but I'll go ahead and give a list of some here that I intend to cover in the near future. And I have no particular timeline on it, but just pay attention to my show, and we'll get to the issues. I want to discuss Jews in Hollywood. I want to do sort of a racial timeline for the early United States history. Martin Luther King Jr., Norse spirituality, Freemasonry, miscegenation, Anton LaVey and fake Satanism, Albert Pike, the Scottish Rite, and the truth about the KKK. And I also want to bring on a friend of mine in the very near future to discuss the sources of National Socialism. He's done some very good research in that area, and I think you might be surprised at what you hear. And again, what I just listed will not necessarily be in that order, but I am leaning towards miscegenation as possibly being the next topic. I also have to cover various aspects of U.S. history. History is just sorely lacking among most of us and severely distorted as well. I have a gazillion things that I could talk about. But nevertheless, I wanted to mention one more thing. before we go to a music break. There's a communist tactic that gets used and is being used currently in this country. And what they like to do is they like to run down the current government solely for the purpose of making it appear that an alternative form of government would be better. Now, I will agree, we certainly need a new constitution, but keep in mind, when you do hear things that are bad about our government, they may be true, but at the same time, there's a reason that they are running it into the ground. And so a lot of that has been done by plenty of times by the communists in the past when they're ready to bring down a country. And again, that is to run down the existing government. Okay, Kyle, well, why don't you play the next song before we get into the topics here? And I'll be back with that.
There's no way out of here when you come in, you're in for good. There was no promise made, the part you played, the chance you took. There are no boundaries set, the time and yet you wasted still. Grains of sand, you watch it go. There's no time to be lost, you'll pay the cost, so get it right. There's no way out of here when you come in, you're in for good. No.
Well, I hope you guys like that song. That's an old David Gilmour song from his first solo album that he did in the late 70s. That's one of those songs that I used to just sit and play over and over and over again. I just never could get tired of it. I hope you guys like it, too. I hope you guys like my music. It's from the from a day gone past, but it's from a time when white people still knew who they were. Jews may have been running this country, but they were not as prominent and overt with a lot of the things they were doing back then. We still had some semblance of who we were as a people. And even though the Immigration Act of 1965 modified the circumstances into what we are and living in right now, it took a little while for that impact to happen. And, you know, I grew up as a teenager in the 70s, and of course I was in my 20s in the 80s, and I've heard a lot of people mock a lot of the music from that time frame, and to some extent with good reason, but there was still a lot of good music that came out of that era. So anyway, we'll move on to the topic of this evening, which is political Judaism analyzed, and in particular its effect on the Gentile people, and in particular for our future. So, Jews, what are they? A race? A religion? An ethnicity? A race religion? A race ethnicity? Well, let me give you an example here. Let's say I marry a Chinese woman and we have children. And some time goes by and either she passes away or I divorce her. And let's say I marry a black woman and we have children. Well, obviously all of my descendants are going to be descended from me, but they are all going to be of a different race. So what are Jews? Well, that's a good question. I'll leave that for you people to ponder. What I've got here is a posting in response to an article in one of the Yahoo groups that I was in. And this goes back to prior to the 2004 so-called elections, presidential elections. The guy had posted a link to an article, and then he did a follow-up post to it, and he added his own information to it to help clarify the article. And I'm going to read to you tonight this guy's response to the article, and then we'll get into some of the contents of the article that he posted. And you'll grasp what's going on the closer we get to the end of it. But anyway, I'll go ahead and start. You have to ask yourself this: what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? It's not pretty. So anyway, here we go. The beginning of the letter. I'm glad you enjoyed the article, but wait a minute. It is not my heritage, but rather an environment that I was subjected to because of my mother's marriage to my stepdad. My blood relatives are not Jewish. I can see all sides of the issue because of exposure to the environment I was brought up in. I did live among the left-wing globalist Jews as well as among the right-wing religious Jews. I knew Jews who boasted of their willingness to commit terrorist acts if it would aid Israel. I encountered members of the Jewish mafia. I've seen Jews lie, cheat, and steal when they knew they could get away with it. The sad part of my life was that I was derived of my heritage while growing up. Life was normal until I was 7, and then whammo, I was sucked into this hellish twilight zone of Jew world. I spent a greater part of my younger life asking, how could there be such horrible people in this world? This isn't to say that I didn't encounter Jews who were kind, but their kindness was always conditional. Again, this is this own guy's words. Okay, this is the thrust of his post right here. There are currently in the world two competing visions of world order. There are currently in the world two competing visions. Both of them originate from Judaism. Each side hates each other, but both sides are deadly for us because they seek to destroy us. I have a unique life experience and learning that I will share with you to help you understand what this is about. I was born to Christian parents, one Catholic, one Baptist, each with a long American heritage reaching back into the 1600s, including an early Jamestown settler on my mother's side. My mother divorced and remarried a Jew. I was raised in a Jewish household for a large part of my childhood. I graduated from an Orthodox Jewish high school. The result is that I have a very inside view of Jews, Judaism, and Jewish thought. My mother is also a volunteer for the most radical right-wing Zionist causes. And yes, she is a strong supporter of President Bush. Again, this is prior to the 2004 elections. One fortunate part of my Jewish education is that I studied Jewish history for several years. One part that conspiracy theorists get wrong is the notion that Judaism is monolith. It is not. Jews quarrel with one another just like anyone else. There is, however, one constant in all types of Jewish practice and political orientation: the belief that peace in the world is obtained through a perfect world government. The differing factions of Jews bitterly disagree on how this should come about and how it should. But no matter what, this belief in salvation through government touches the life of every Jew, whether they are atheists, religious, or otherwise. Let me begin with traditional Orthodox Judaism. Traditional Orthodox Judaism teaches that someday there will be a holy war of good versus evil, all the pro-Jewish forces against the anti-Jewish forces. There is a name for this war. It is called Michaelmas Amalek, or the war with Amalek, and I'm just going to try to use that. I'm not sure how to pronounce that other word. The nation of Amalek symbolizes to the Jewish people any person with an inability to accept the Jew and what the Jew stands for. As commanded, Amalek must be wiped out from the faith. This, in the nation, or the war with Amalek, rather, thus, in the war with Amalek, every human being who resists Jewish power will be identified with this nation of Amalek and killed. When this is accomplished, the Jews will identify and crown the King Messiah, who is none other than the Antichrist of Christianity. Since the exile of the Jews after the destruction of the Second Temple, most Jews have been pretty low-key about this. They accepted their exile as a punishment from God and believe that they must await God's intervention for their redemption. In the end, it would be God who rids the world of Amalek and allows the Jews to re-enter the Promised Land in a miraculous fashion. Today, there exists only a small fraction of Jews who still maintain this belief. Their major group is called the Naturae Carta. I know I didn't pronounce the first word right either. And they maintain a website called JewsNotZionists.com. They believe that any attempt by Jews to obtain worldly power is a recipe for anti-Semitism. I personally believe that history proves it to be correct. Nevertheless, there have been some periods where Jews started to take matters into their own hands. In the 17th century, a false messiah, Shabbatai Tzvi, is a notable example. Embarrassment from this episode brought some humility to the Jews, and they went back to waiting on God for their deliverance for a few centuries. The real change and source of divisions among Jews concerning world order began in the 19th century. At that time, there arose two new visions for a Jewish future: Marxism and Zionism. What both of these movements had in common was a refusal to patiently await redemption from God. Both Marxism and Zionism decided to take matters into their own hands. Initially, religious Jews opted out of both Marxism and Zionism and considered both of these movements to be heretical. It should be noted here that in the 17th century, a movement called the Haskalah, or Enlightenment, encouraged a moving away from Jewish tradition, belief, and practice. For the Masculine, or adherents of the Haskalah, the Jewish identity became more racially than spiritually defined. Since these Jews no longer expect divine intervention or deliverance, they looked for a new way of bringing about their deliverance themselves. This result produced the two visions, Marxism and Zionism. As previously mentioned, the one bond among all Jews is the vision of a world government. Ironically, Zionism started out very much in opposition to the idea of world government. More about that later. Let's begin with Marxism. Since a Messiah was no longer going to redeem Israel, and since the land of Israel no longer was important, the Jewish mission was seen as one of righting political wrongs and of the correction of the oppression against various oppressed classes, such as workers, i.e. those who did not own any land. Marxism was an attempt to secure justice worldwide for all. The idea of world government did not disappear with the religion. It was only transformed. Instead of a world government headed by Jews with Jerusalem and Israel at the center, there would be a world government by all people. Jews would lead and encourage, but not necessarily rule. The result of the Haskalah was that non-religious Jews were increasingly getting involved in world politics and working towards globalist aims, and of course Marxism was one form of this that this took. For the sake of simplicity, I'll refer to these various groups of Jews as globalists, which include both Marxist and Jewish capitalists, and promoters of world finance, such as the House of Rothschild. This globalist vision meant that Jews were increasingly found in positions of power and that non-Jews were starting to resist the presence of Jews in high positions. The Maskilim of all stripes were hostile to European Christian values. Jewish power in Republican France did persecute Christianity. An assault on morality and values was a method of destroying the Christian barriers to the enlightened Jewish view of world government. Freemasonry, especially Grand Orient Freemasonry, played its role in encouraging non-Jews to embrace this globalist view. While not denying a person their personal practice of religion, Freemasonry labored to erase the church. The church was declared to be a source of division and oppression. As a result, the reaction from the masses was hostility. In France, this reached its zenith in the Alfred Dreyfus case. Observing that the misuse of Jewish power created a backlash of anti-Semitism, Zionist founder Theodor Herzl came to the conclusion that Jews should not be involved at all in the governance of non-Jews. Herzl believed that Jews and non-Jews were essentially incompatible and should live separately. The solution was for Jews to live in their own state and to leave the affairs of other nations to themselves. It was vital that the Jewish state not depend on other nations or influence other nations or exploit other nations. Jews would do their own labor, for instance. Now, when's the last time you saw a Jew do any labor? This was important because Jews were often accused of avoiding labor and being only middlemen. Jews would end anti-Semitism by ending the Jewish actions that caused anti-Semitism. This could only be achieved if all Jews moved to a Jewish state. Still at this point, the Jews who still followed the Talmud and Jewish traditions, for the most part, wanted nothing of either Zionism or globalism. Non-religious Jews, however, became very polarized over these two competing views. Reform Judaism, which was very entrenched in globalism, in fact, one could almost say that the core of Reform Judaism is globalism, initially rejected Zionism. Zionism was initially embraced by the conservative wing of Judaism. Note that conservative Judaism refers not to Talmudic or traditional Judaism, but rather to a movement that grew out of Reform Judaism's moving too far to the left. Orthodox Jews, as mentioned before, for the most part, stayed out of this. Unfortunately, a handful of religious Jews did not stay out. While no religious Jews embraced globalism, some did embrace Zionism, but with a twist. A twist that sadly transformed Zionism from a once noble idea into the frightening machine of oppression and extortion that it is today. Herzl's original vision was mutated into an even greater scheme for Jewish power. These religious Jews, led by Rav Avraham Kook, that's spelled K-O-O-K, and that's where you get the term Kook from. That's probably an old-fashioned term that young people don't use anymore, but usually it was always in reference to someone who was a nut job. You just call them a kook. So anyway, these religious Jews, led by Rav Avram Kook, saw the pursuit of Zionism as a persecutor to the fulfillment of Jewish messianic dreams. During the same period, the Iraqi rabbi Ben Ish Hai wrote of the days that will come when Israel will take all the wealth from the nations and the nations will assume their rightful place as servants of Israel. These religious Zionists rejected the earlier passive approach to Jewish redemption and taught that God wanted the redemption to come from the efforts of the Jews themselves. The liberties represent, in some way, these two visions of Zionism. Lukid is very much messianic, whereas labor represents more the original vision of a self-sufficient Israel, somewhat socialist Israel, which does not have any pretensions to world power. Broken man. He lived to see his original vision perverted into its polar opposite. The capture of Zion as necessary to begin the march to the religious Jewish domination of the world. Even at this point, most religious Jews did not go along with the Zionist movement. But the fact remains that those religious Jews who did not get involved pretty much shaped the version of Zionism that exists today. At the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, most non-religious Jews were on the globalist and especially the Marxist side of things. The origin of the left here in the United States is rooted in this group, and they will represent what is now the Democrat Party today. The aims and values of the American left are pretty much synonymous with the aims and values of these non-religious Jews. At that time, there really weren't any Jews aligned with the right or conservative faction. In the early 20th century, globalist Jews shaped the world through the expansion of international finance and communism, two twin evils that have eroded the strength of European-American peoples. Jews have promoted themselves as friends of humanity, and the world listened. In the background, were the Zionists. During the same period, other Jews who had neither the secular vision of Herzl nor the religious vision of Kook started to take a look at the advantage that a Jewish Zionist nation would afford. Rather than Zion being a place for all Jews to go to leave the rest of the world alone, Zion would be a place that Jews could run to if they were chased out of other lands. In other words, Zion would function as a safe house for Jews in trouble elsewhere. Most Jews would live outside of the Zionist state, but the state would be there for refuge. Again, Herzl was so devastated to see his Zionist vision being turned into an excuse for Jews to behave with impunity around the world, since they could have just escaped into Israel if they misbehaved. This was mostly on the back burner and didn't really become a significant factor until after World War II. World War II was the catalyst that brought most of the Jewish world into sympathy with Zionism. For most Jews, Palestine was the necessary refuge, and most of the world accepted that this was necessary by that time. Unfortunately, few heeded Herzl's warnings about unjustly displacing the indigenous peoples of Palestine, and the Middle East has been a disaster for the past half century. Now we are getting close to the point in history where all of this comes together and has a direct effect on our current 2004 presidential election. The Six-Day War of 1967. For most Jews, the victory of this war was nothing short. At this point, the perspective of most religious Jews began to change. Many of these Jews began to accept the view of the late Rav Kook. Additionally, there was another perspective, emphasized by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, that by Jewish law, once Jews obtained part of this historical homeland, they were forbidden to let go of it. What this meant was that while religious Jews did not participate for the most part in the struggle to obtain Palestine, now that they had it, not an inch could be surrendered under any circumstance. More and more Orthodox religious Jews began to see the Zionist state as the beginning of their long hope for messianic redemption and shed their previous passive expectation. This shift in attitude towards a Zionist state was significant. It meant that formerly non-political religious Jews were turning to politics to influence the world on behalf of Israel. This was also coupled with a return by many to Orthodox Judaism in the 1960s. While many youth, mainly baby boomers, were experimenting with drugs and alternative religious ideas and practices during the 1960s and 1970s, many Jews found their way back to Orthodox Judaism. Some of those who found their way back were former radicals and participants in left-wing politics. Slowly, they moved right. They represented, in part, the seeds of the neocon right. Now, you've heard in the past different people talking about this, or they've put it in articles that they've written, you know, about how all of the neocons are essentially former Trotskyites. Well, that explains where that comes from. Okay, back to the letter. As they rediscovered Judaism, they came to embrace some of the values of the conservative right. They rejected feminism and abortion, for instance. These Jews tended to vote Republican. At current time, the fact is that there is just as much threat to the world from the Jewish liberal left as the religious Jewish right. For convenience, I will now refer to the Jewish right as neoconservatism. The core issue of the Jewish right, which many are unaware of, is that they have become very open about their desire to complete the Jewish messianic redemption. It would be appropriate at this time to speak of the nature of Jewish messianic redemption, a redemption which at its heart is centered on the idea of holy war. The Michaelmas or Michaelmas Amalek mentioned at the beginning of this article. Many, by the way, many Zionist Christians can tell you about that. I've been surprised many times talking to some that they actually knew about this. No longer is there a passive wait for redemption for most religious Jews. Many feel they have a mandate to bring history to its completion. Just what is the vision of religious Judaism for the world? Well, that is ruled by Talmudic law. And I would say at this point, let's go ahead and take a break, and I'm going to drink some water. And Kyle, can you play the next song, please?
Don't know what
They did was great. So anyway, we're back to discuss rule by Talmudic law. Judaism teaches that there were two covenants made with man, one with Gentiles and one with the Jews. Jews are more or less the extension of God's will on earth, and thus the world is only in order when Jews run it. The Jewish covenant contains 613 laws, which have been elaborated, twisted, and mangled into the encyclopedic Talmud. Like Islamic Sharia law, the Talmud relegated every aspect of life for the Jew. For the non-Jew, there is the seven-law Noahide covenant, which is also elaborated on in Tractate Sanhedrin of the Talmud. Ultimately, the day should come when all Jews are subject to the Torah and all Gentiles subject to Noahide law. One of the main tasks of the Messiah would be to reestablish the Jewish and Noahide law courts throughout the world. Jews who reject their Talmudic masters will be killed, as will non-Jews who resist the Noahide code. The Messiah is only able to come and establish this system of rule when three conditions have been met. Number one, the retrieval of all biblical lands of Israel / Judea. This includes much of Iraq, by the way. Number two, the extermination of Amalek and the Arab Rav. Number three, the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. What most people should know is that religious Jews, and especially the neocons, are trying to bring about all three of these conditions. The first two conditions require a holy war, both for retrieving the land and for killing off all potential opponents to Jewish world rule. The third condition is also in progress, as there are frequent there are frequently news stories about the danger of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which sits on top of the so-called Second Temple. Actually, it was their first. There never was a First Temple. Muslims are warned that the structure might collapse. This would not be from natural causes, although the Israelis might try to make it appear so. Once the mosque is gone, the religious right neocons will feel they have a mandate to complete the holy war. The behavior of Israel against Palestine and the current treatment of Iraqis by the U.S.-Israel coalition should be a good indication of how Jews treat their foes. One thing that the neocons expect is that they will eventually wage war with the Jewish left and the nations, such as the EU, that are pretty much in step with the goals of the Jewish left. The destruction of Russia is high on the list of enemy nations to be destroyed with Amalek. Ironically, the neocons believe that eventually the non-Palestinian Arabs will side with them. Remember all the propaganda on how the Iraqis would greet the American soldiers with open arms? The goal of war against the Muslim nations is to, number one, obtain the lands required for the Messiah, and number two, to get the Arabs allied with the Jews to fight Russia and Europe. Again, it is well to remember that the neocon Jews know that they will be fighting the powers built up by the leftist globalist Jews in the end. Somewhere in this process, they expect a mass apostasy from Christianity by the evangelistic supporters of the neocons. They expect that when the Christians see the great victories of the Jews, they will realize they were in error and that there will be no second coming of Christ, but only the coming of the Jewish Messiah. Christians who fail to realize this will be killed in the end. So what does this mean for the coming elections? Again, this is prior to 2004. It means that while the globalist left will continue to inflict harm to white Europeans and gradually erode their numbers and culture, the neocon right will be far less gradual and more swiftly to progress their holy war. If the globalists are in power, there is more time to educate our people to the evils of both the right and the left, which have been taken over by warring factions of Jews. If the neocons win, it is as simple as that. The neocon rightist Jews recognize the so-called war on terror as nothing other than Amalek itself. This means they have no intention of stopping. Genocidal plans are carried out. The world must be educated to the Jewish peril on the right even before it wakes up to the peril on the left, because time is short. Everyone has heard of globalism. Almost no one, even Jews, have heard of Michaelmas Amalek. We need to call the beast by its name and let the neocons know that we know their game. It is not just a simple war on terror, but an alternative negative Jewish utopia with even more deadly consequences than that of the left. If the neocons win and we are able to educate the world about Michaelmas Amalek, the effect will be that the neocons will go after us and be in the open about their war. What I'm trying to say is that they are so crazed they will not hesitate to use nukes and any other weapons of mass destruction or false flag terrorism to achieve their goals. It is useless worrying about issues like gay marriage or abortion when our very people and lives are at stake in the short run. Yes, gay marriage and abortion harms our numbers, but it harms them over a gradual period. Michaelmas Amalek will inflict death on hundreds of millions in one turn. I can't make this clear enough that these people are crazy enough to do it. For this reason, there is no way we can return them to office. We need to buy time. We need to educate the world so they don't ever fall for this lethal political persuasion. We need to guarantee that people understand the neocons are not an alternative, no matter how bad the globalist left is. Just because they call themselves Republicans doesn't mean they are Republicans. Let's get over that for the time being. We have time to resist the left and right. They're wrong. That time does not exist if we elect Bush to another 4 years. For the sake of securing the existence of our people and a future for white children, we must use every means possible to prevent the return of Bush and the Zionist neocons into office. It is in our best interest to return the Jews to the position they were in back in the 17th century after the humiliation of Jebatai Tzvi. Perhaps when the Jews learn they once again overstepped their reach and the world will not tolerate their arrogance, they will at least for a few centuries be less of a menace to a Western man. That ends the letter. And the person who wrote it was, first initial is P, last name Myers. And I believe that is actually Peter Myers, if anyone knows the man over the net. I used to be on his list a long time ago. Okay, let's go ahead and take another musical break and since we've finished the letter. And we'll get into the Noahide laws after this. Kyle?
Just
Okay, I'm back. In case you don't know who that was Pat Travers. Let's see here. Oh, and by the way, damn, I just spilled my wine. No, I didn't. I'm just kidding. Okay. All right. So, now, what the hell has happened to separation of church and state? Now, I guess a synagogue doesn't meet the qualifications for a church, so they get a pass on that. So anyway, okay, the Noahide laws. Now, many of you have heard of these. You're probably familiar with them. You may even be aware that they are coded into our law in this country already. But I'm going to go ahead and go through a little bit of some of these, and with a little commentary on them and some other surrounding information to these. And I want to put them on record with this network, because the way I see it, what this network should be, among many things, is a repository of information. And we can always go back to one of our shows that we've done, or somebody else has done, whatever the case may be, and listen to it again. Hear what it was that was said and what was discussed. And that's to me, that's important. So I don't know how everybody else here feels, but that's my thoughts on it. So anyway, the Noahide laws. Well, I'm going to read a quote here that was a pledge made by the children of Noah in front of the Israeli Sanhedrin on January 10th, 2006. Now, the children of Noah essentially are Gentiles who adhere to the Noahide laws. Quote, "I pledge my allegiance to Hashem, God of Israel, creator and king of the universe, to his Torah and its representatives, the developing Sanhedrin. I hereby pledge to uphold the seven laws of Noah in all their details, according to the oral law of Moses, under the guidance of the developing Sanhedrin. May Hashem bless and aid me, my fellow council members, and all B'nai Noach in our endeavors for the sake of his name. Blessed are you, God, King of the universe, who has caused me to live, sustained me, and brought me to this day." End quote. And Yitzhak David Smith says, "The Torah-mandated role of Judaism is the only true religion for all of mankind, either as Jews or as B'nai Noach." Essentially, again, the children, the Gentiles who adhere to the Noahide laws, the children of Noah. Smith continues, "There's no room for dialogue with other religions for the purification of Christianity or Lost Ten Tribes theology. These falsehoods are destructive anti-Torah viewpoints. The Rabbam Schneerson writes that the time will come when Christians and Muslims will realize that their religions are false and fault their forefathers for teaching it to them. They will accept the one God of the Jewish people, and all other religions or variation will be abolished in their entirety. The time for this is now, and all other approaches only are intended to delay the revelation of the absolute truth of Torah in the entire world." End quote. Another Lubavitcher article writes in the Final War for Jerusalem proclaims, quote, "In reality, neither the Jewish people nor the Gentiles support the betrayal of Israel. And essentially all 6 billion Gentiles are quite ready to ask the Jews for spiritual leadership in these times of darkness. Judaism has always been a conquering religion, not for the purpose of converting to become Jews, but rather the mission of returning the world to the universal covenant between God and Noah. For halachic reasons, too numerous and detailed to list here, Gentiles today who follow Christianity, Islam, or other religions aren't, for the most part, religious Gentiles who inherit the world to come. That status belongs only to those Gentiles who carefully observe the laws of Noah, including the halachic authority of the Torah and the rabbis. And as the Lubavitcher Rebbe has explained, by transforming the Gentiles, we can quickly create a vast army of supporters who will help us reveal Mashiach and bring all Jews back to the Torah. Specifically, the Rebbe has emphasized the peace process in Israel will be defeated only through our influence on the Gentiles, especially through the campaign to teach the Noahide laws. Our most pressing task, put it simply, is to launch an international Noah Hyde revolution without delay. The process has already begun, with dozens of tiny Noah Hyde communities having appeared throughout the United States, generally composed of former Christians who have abandoned that religion. The growing Noah Hyde movement will seize political power using only peaceful, lawful means in the capitals of the Western nations. This, of course, will not take until the Noah Hyde Society has grown to some threshold size. We do not know how large this needs to be, nor which nations will join the revolution first. Although the United States is a fairly religious conservative nation, certainly tops the list of prospects. I'm going to take a drink of water here. Give me just a second. The difference, let's see, wait a minute. In Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel by Israel Shehak and Norton Mizvinsky, the authors are quoted in a review by Alan C. Braunfeld as relating to the following quotes by Rabbi Schneerson. The difference between a Jewish and a non-Jewish person stems from the common expression, "Let us differentiate." Thus, we do not have a case of profound change in which merely on a superior level. Case of "Let us differentiate between totally different species." That is what needs to be said about the body. The body of a Jewish person is totally different quality from the body of all nations of the world. A non-Jew's entire reality is only vanity. It is written, "And the strangers shall guard and feed your flocks." Comes from Isaiah 5. The entire creation, meaning of non-Jews, exists only for the sake of the Jews. Braunfeld also writes, "What particularly authors," referencing this Jewish fundamentalism, "is a total contempt with Jewish fundamentalists show towards non-Jews. Rabbi Kook the Elder, the Reverend Father of the Messianic tendency of Jewish fundamentalism, said, Jewish soul and souls of non-Jews, all of them in all different levels, is greater and deeper than the difference between human soul and the souls of cattle." Rabbi Kook's entire teaching, which is followed devoutly by, among others, those who have led the settler movement on the occupied West Bank, is based upon the Lurianic Kabbalah, the school of Gnosticism that dominated Judaism from the late 16th to the early 19th centuries. One of the basic tenets of the Lurianic Kabbalah, the authors write, is the absolute superiority of the Jewish soul and body over the non-Jewish soul and body. According to the Lurianic Kabbalah, the world was created solely for the sake of Jews. The existence of non-Jews was subsidiary. If an influential Christian bishop or Islamic scholar argued that the difference between the superior souls of non-Jews and the inferior souls of Jews was greater than the difference between souls and souls of cattle, he would incur the wrath of all and be viewed as an anti-Semite by most Jewish scholars, regardless of whatever less meaningful possibilities he included. Braunfeld further states, Rabbi Schneerson always supported the Israeli retreat. In 1974, he strongly opposed the Israeli withdrawal from the Suez area. He promised Israel divine favors if it persisted in occupying the land. After his death, thousands of his Israeli followers played an important role in the election victory of Benjamin Netanyahu. Among the religious settlers in the occupied territories, the Chinese constitute one of the most extreme groups. Baruch Goldstein, the mass murderer of the Palestinians, was one of them. Rabbi Yitzhak Ginsburg, who wrote a chapter of a book in praise of Goldstein and what he did, is another member of this group. An immigrant to the U.S., Rabbi speaks freely of Jews' genetic-based spiritual superiority over non-Jews. If you saw two people drowning, a Jew and a non-Jew, the Torah says you saved them first, Ginsburg states. If every simple cell in a Jewish body entails divinity, it is part of God, then every strand of DNA is part of God. Therefore, something is special about Jewish DNA. If a Jew needs a liver, can you take the liver of an innocent non-Jew passing by to save him? The Torah would probably permit that. Jewish life has an infinite value. These Jews want a dictatorship. Under this dictatorship, books would be banned and burned. Freethinkers would be jailed or executed. If the Hasidic Jewish movement has its way, the so-called Noahide laws will be followed, as with many others found in the Old Testament, prescribing capital punishment for abortion, euthanasia, and sexual deviation, such as adultery and homosexuality. The punishment, in fact, for breaking any of the Noahide laws is decapitation. Now, some believe that decapitation prevents the ability of the soul to transmigrate. Now, transmigration is an aspect of what is called reincarnation. And I'll touch on that just a little bit here. I'm not going to spend much time on it, but basically, most people are familiar with reincarnation. Yes, you may come back as someone else, something else, or possibly even an insect. But transmigration is more specific. In other words, you would come back in a similar form as to what you are now, perhaps even a descendant of yourself later in time. And back to the Noahide laws. Although the term Noahide laws is not widely known, it is fairly common knowledge among the political and religious power mongers, allegedly representing holy writ passed along to Noah prior to the Great Flood. According to some, these laws are to be the basis of one world religion being pushed by what is written in the Committee of 300 so-called New World Order. You will not find this in the Bible. To my knowledge, it is only in the Talmud. It could be in other Jewish books. I'm not sure, but that's where I have been informed that it comes from. Ultraist intentions are displayed by the Temple Mount and Eretz Yisrael faithful movement in Jerusalem, a supposedly fringe group with Knesset connections that advocates as one of its long-term objectives the following: consecrating the Temple Mount to the name of God so that it can become the moral and spiritual center of Israel, of the Jewish people, and of the entire world, according to the words of all the Hebrew prophets. It is envisioned that the consecration of the Temple Mount and the temple itself will focus Israel on, number one, fulfilling the vision and mission given at Mount Sinai for Israel to be a chosen people, separate unto God, a holy nation, and a nation of priests, and, number two, becoming a light unto all the nations, so that the name of God may be revered by all nations, and the biblical way of life may be propagated throughout the world. And that can be found in Isaiah 42:6. The Temple Mount faithful group claimed the United States founded by God to stand with Israel against her enemies. It further asserts that anyone who moves against Israel is anti-God. Israel and people are essentially equated with God, but all others are not. Another quote from the Temple Mount faithful: no one can stop the God of Israel. Now, what I want to do here is I want to read the actual law that's on the books. And this was passed by Congress as a joint resolution and signed by George H.W. Bush, 6, 1991. The bill was passed by the House on March 5th and was passed by the Senate on March 7th of 1991. The proclamation is as follows: whereas Congress recognized the historical tradition of ethical values and principles which are the basis of civilized society on which our great nation was founded, whereas these ethical principles have been the bedrock of society from the dawn of civilization, when they referred to as the seven Noahide laws. Now, where the fuck did that come from? Whereas, without these ethical values and principles, the edifice of civilization stand in serious peril to chaos. Well, not for that reason. Whereas society is profoundly concerned with the recent weakening of these principles that has resulted in crisis that beleaguer and threaten the fabric of civilized society. Whereas a justified preoccupation with these crises must not let the citizens of the nation lose sight their responsibility to transmit these historical ethical values from our distinguished past to the generations of the future. Whereas the Lubavitch movement has fostered and promoted these ethical values and principles, whereas Rabbi Mendel Schneerson, leader of the Lubavitch movement, is universally respected and revered, and his 89th birthday falls on March 26, 1991. Whereas in tribute to this great spiritual leader, the Rebbe, his 90th year will be seen as one of education and giving, the year in which we turn education and charity to return the moral and ethical values contained in the 7 Noahide laws. And whereas this will be reflected in an international scroll of honor signed by the President of the United States and other heads of state, now therefore be it resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled that March 26, 1991, the start of the 90th year of Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, leader of the worldwide Lubavitch movement, is designated as Education Day USA. The President is requested to issue a proclamation calling upon the people of the United States to observe such day with appropriate ceremonies and activities. Now, I don't know about you, but I haven't been paying attention to March 26. Maybe we should start watching this date a little closer. But anyway, okay, I'm going to go ahead and take one last break before we wrap up the show. So, Kyle, can you play one more? Thank you. Okay, I'm back. What are the Noahide laws? Again, the Noahide laws are said to be from the Bible, but evidently are Talmudic. The Encyclopedia Americana relates concerning the Noahide laws the following. A Jewish Talmudic designation for seven biblical laws given to Adam and to Noah before the revelation to Moses on Mount Sinai, and consequently binding all mankind. Beginning with Genesis 2:16, the Babylonian Talmud listed the first six commandments. After the flood, the seventh commandment given to Noah forbade the eating of flesh from living animals. That's Genesis 9:4. Throughout the ages, scholars have viewed the Noahide laws as a link between Judaism and Christianity, as universal norms of ethical conduct, as a basic concept of international law, or as a guarantee of fundamental human rights for all. Really? Let's take a look, shall we? There have been a number of calls for the establishment of justice based upon the seven mitzvot of the children of Noah, or seven commandments of Noah, which are claimed to be universal. In essence, Judeo-centric writers and leaders wish to impose laws upon the rest of the world. The order of the laws varies from source to source, but I will run through this one version called the Chabad version. The first Noahide law, thou shalt not engage in idol worship. Idolatry is clarified as any teaching or belief system that attempts to deify man or any man, humanize as idolatry. Since the definition of idolatry is also culturally dependent, Christians, Buddhists, and Hindus, among others, would all be criminals. Islam, of course, takes this law to the extreme, fervently banning idolatrous images. However, according to this Noahide law, Muslims who worship the Kaaba stone at Mecca would be subject to punishment as well, although supposedly. The list for this is infinite, nitpicking over the smallest minute detail, including forbidden and permissible rocks, trees, water, ghosts, and spirits, and how to nullify idolatrous images, witchcraft, divination, on and on and on, are debatable to their permissibility under the Noahide law as to what one must, as one must be a true wizard to be liable for death by stoning. Astrology that determines a person's character is permissible but forecasts the future or not. The second Noahide law, thou shalt not blaspheme God. It is further referenced at Leviticus 24:16. He who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him. The sojourner as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death. The concept of God has been culturally dependent, and those freethinkers who have questioned it often constituted some of the most intelligent, honest, and brave human beings around. This would catch in its deadly net not only atheists, who make up a tiny, highly persecuted minority, but evidently also anyone who did not agree with the Judaic interpretation of God by the Torah, Tanakh, which is the Old Testament, and the Talmud. In other words, the vengeful tribal god Yahweh, cursing the gods of other cultures by calling them idols, however, is not punishable. Interpretation, it is the duty of a pious Jew to place the blasphemer under a ban of excommunication. The belief in two powers, God and Satan, is also considered blasphemy, for God is Lord and Master. Ditto with the belief in Lucifer as a rebellious angel. False or meaningless oaths taken in the name of God are all forbidden, except, of course, for the Kol Nidre prayer said each year at Yom Kippur, wherein pious can retract those made during the coming year. One who curses in the name of idolatry is subject to being attacked and killed by zealots who are, in turn, held harmless by law. Surprisingly, this Noahide law is clarified by saying that no one should refrain from insulting one's fellow man because man was made in God's image, and hence one would be blaspheming. Fellow man evidently refers only to a pious Jew or Gentile Noahide, while asserting that God is absolutely separate, such that worshiping him in the creation is idolatry. This Noahide law, nonetheless, paradoxically, prescribes that one recognize the divine hand in everything and abstain as much as possible from speaking ill of any aspect of creation. The third Noahide law, murder. Murder has been defined by many people as essentially anything that's not accidental death. Thou shalt not shed innocent blood of any human or fetus, nor ailing person who has a limited time to live. This law is based on Genesis 9:6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed. Putting people to death for blaspheming the name of the Omnipotent, who cannot possibly be harmed by such assaults, does not constitute murder. Nor would it be murder to slaughter entire cultures, in other words, genocide, in that very same sacrosanct name, as is the behavior of the chosen people depicted throughout the Old Testament. Such murder, as long as it is done by the group who makes up the rules, is apparently acceptable. Basically, too, the Bible says that one can do anything as long as it is okay by Yahweh. And if Yahweh says, okay, fine, go ahead, you can do it. Whereas other times, no, you can't. Under this law, doctors who perform abortions, along with their nurses and patients themselves, could also be put to death. Someone who strikes a woman and kills her fetus receives a death penalty, provided the fetus is more than 40 days old. If under 40 days old, it is considered the same as the destruction of the man's seed, which is an offense to be judged in heaven, not on earth. Euthanasia or mercy killing, no matter how much the suffering, is punishable by death. Although some authorities claim it is permissible to save a woman's life by aborting the fetus, others proscribe it. After much bickering, it is concluded that spilling one's seed or male masturbation is strictly forbidden, as it is equivalent to murdering one's own children. In other words, male masturbation is punishable by death. This also begs the question of, if one does not ever have sex, then what happens? Semen eventually builds up and comes out on its own. This is what is known as a wet dream. So you're gonna die for a wet dream? This is nuts. These people are crazy. The fourth law is against illicit sex. Thank goodness for the mute button. I can cough without y'all hearing me. Thou shalt not engage in bestial, incestuous, adulterous, or homosexual relations, nor commit the act of rape. This law also prescribes fornication, i.e., sex outside of marriage. However, polygamy, or more appropriately, polygyny, or many wives, is exempt from this law, as is the possession of concubines. The determination of what is considered sexually immoral has been a cultural artifact, not a writ from God. Cultures that have different sexual practices, such as the Tibetans, who for centuries practiced polyandry, or many husbands, would be considered deviant and criminal. The Tibetans have practical reasons for such practices. They lacked land and had to keep the population down. What is considered adulterous has likewise been culturally dependent. Under this law, a man could get the death penalty for having sex with his mother-in-law, for example. Like the biblical scriptures, the Noahide laws do not prescribe lesbianism. However, it is considered immoral and against natural laws, or rather against the natural order. Male homosexuality, in whatever form and whether with an adult or child, consensual or rape, private or public, punishable by death. Under the Noahides, a man can have sex with a Gentile wife of a Jew, because she's not really his wife and is therefore unmarried. A Jewish wife is off limits. A man may also practice sodomy or other non-vaginal relations with a married woman, and such will not be considered adultery. The commentary on this Noahide law relates, one who forbidden member of the opposite sex, or hugs or kisses in a manner of lust, or who has close personal contact for the sake of pleasure, transgresses the commandment prohibiting forbidden relationships, that he is not punished by the courts. In all cases where the courts are not empowered to act, punishment is meted out by God. One must also not flirt with a forbidden woman in any way, shape, or form. More commentary. Relations with an animal are forbidden at any stage of the animal's maturity, even its birth. Now that's interesting. Even the day of his birth seems to imply there was some doubt that it was wrong to have sex with an animal when it was newborn. Incest is permissible when not siblings are not maternally related. Clarification. Church and Noah are considered related only through the mother. Those on the father's side are not considered relatives. This means that a man's half-sister of the same father, but a different mother, is not considered related to him and is permissible to him. Now, on that subject there of a man's half-sister of the same father, many monarchies have practiced that as a rule of thumb for descent because of having... Of all the problems of actually having relations with your sister from both parents. So the man would have sexual relations with his half-sister. The fifth Noahide law is against theft. Thou shalt not steal. The term theft is ambiguous, as one could easily argue the case that the Federal Reserve's business is theft. While the Noahide cult considers adultery as theft of the wife, it doesn't seem to recognize that taking sons and daughters away from their mothers and fathers through warfare and the murder of infidels could also constitute theft. Forcing people to conform to a belief in God or other intangible concept would seem to constitute theft of one's intellectual freedom. The theft of a woman during war is prohibited for Gentiles or Noahides, children of Noah. Again, Gentiles who follow the Noahide laws. Jews who follow are called Israelites. Under various circumstances, such as Malkamot Mitzvah, it is permissible for a Jew to steal a woman during war. The children of Noah are forbidden to overcharge or engage in usury. Nothing is said of the children of Israel. The justification for the death penalty for thieving is that the Noahide courts are created to mete out justice so the violator not suffer punishment in the world to come, i.e. the afterlife. They love using that phrase, world to come. Because of the justice of the courts, therefore, a man can transgress and still receive a share of the world to come as a righteous person. It is further believed that at Rosh Hashanah, God decides what wealth one will acquire during the coming year, such that no one can change the outcome. Although this fact is not explicated upon in the Chabad exegesis of the Noahide, in Talmudic law, there's a double standard as concerns theft, as many other things. In many cases, it's permissible for an Israelite to steal from a Gentile. The sixth Noahide law is thou shalt not be cruel to animals. Now, this was the only one that really starts to make any sense. This law prescribes the eating of the limb of a live animal. Eating of the limb of a live animal and incorporates Genesis 9:4, only the flesh with the life thereof, with the blood thereof, shall not eat. It is a saying inhuman enough, although humans could be executed if convicted of cruelty to animals. It appears odd that it was necessary to create a law against eating the limb of a living animal, but apparently there was an epidemic of such behavior among the biblical people. It is evidently permissible Mosaic law to eat an animal after it has been ritually slaughtered while its limbs are still moving, although it is not necessarily still alive, but with brain activity. The debate over which was proper, Mosaic or Noahide law, is presented in the story of Joseph and his brothers, representing one of the reasons Joseph was sold into slavery. Unlike other ideologies, Judaism professes the animals have souls. This law surely seems to be the sanest of the lot, sounding very Jainist in its call to deliberately harming animals and suggesting that those who do so are spiritually unsound, except that it apparently allows for the flaying alive of an animal and use of its hide. Animals killed humanely are available to eat. Gentiles are punishable no matter what animal they eat of the limb, whereas Jews are guilty only if the animal is spiritually clean, those who have split hooves and chew their cud. The justification for this law is that the soul of the animal must be detached from the body before humans can eat it, because while the flesh of a human and animal may become one, their souls must never merge. The final and seventh Noahide law is the so-called courts of justice. Thou shalt establish laws and courts of law to administer these laws, including the death penalty for those who kill, administered only if there is one testifying witness. These courts of justice would be based on the Noahide laws. Harsh punishments, such as the death penalty for breaking any of these laws, would be strictly enforced. According to some sources, Rabbi Menachem Shearsom's disciples would be the governors of these courts of justice. Lovely. According to a Chad opinion, a boy is liable at the age of 13 and a girl at 12, such as they could be executed at these ages. So young boys better start having sex or they could lose their life. You can't spill that seed by accident now, right? Any court that does not follow the Noahides is considered to be an instrument for driving God's blessings out of the world. Failure to establish a Noahide court is punishable by death and is the establishment of a court other than one based on the seven universal laws. If a city does not institute justice according to the Noahide laws, all inhabitants are liable. The only punishment meted out by the Noahide courts of law in criminal cases is the death penalty. The defendant, however, must be judged mentally incompetent. Circumstantial evidence is admissible in a Noahide court. The death penalty for a murderer cannot be appealed and must be carried out swiftly. Judges in the Noahide courts are to be chosen criteria, including that they possess the following: 1, wisdom; 2, humility; 3, fear of heaven; 4, fear of sin; 5, contempt for money; 6, love of truth; 7, beloved by his fellow man; 8, a good reputation. A woman, however, may never be judged, nor can a slave, small child, fool, or the insane. Deaf, mutes, and the blind are also forbidden. Whoever disgraces himself publicly is disqualified as a witness. These are people who walk and eat in a coarse, impolite fashion in public, or who go naked in public, or who are involved in any disgusting work or activity, or anyone who feels no self-embarrassment. All these people are considered on the level of a dog, and we cannot trust them to be stringent against giving false testimony. Although it seems incredible that these archaic and culturally biased laws could be applicable or relevant to 21st century America, the wheels are apparently in motion. Such legislation as that passed under the Bush is indicative of what the future holds, i.e. a fascist theocracy in which the death penalty via decapitation would be wielded freely. So again, what happens if we don't prevail over tyrants? We have our work cut out for us, because that's what they have in store for us. I want to close out with some final thoughts, something you may not have ever considered. All of us are suffering from something called anti-Semitism. It is a disease. Now, how did you catch this disease? Well, you caught it from Jews. They give it to you. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Jesus may love you, but Odin says grow the fuck up. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is permanent. 88, I hope I pass the audition, and hail Satan. So until next time, Kyle, play the music.
Teller.
Satan!